Chapter 6 Relationships, Short-Term, Long-Term, and None. You've met someone who's a real possibility. You're interested and they're interested. You don't know where this could go, but you're willing to pursue it. You just met and spent a few minutes talking, and there's a definite interest. On both sides. This could become, well, think of all the possibilities: a friendship, a short-term romance, or maybe long-term, maybe even marriage. Who knows? What are you looking for? Have you considered letting people know what you are looking for right up front? It's possible, and it can save you and the other person some time and even heartache. Now and then you will find an expression of this in one of the dating ads. Some come right out and say, looking for romance, commitment, and eventually marriage, or lust, want to date and see what happens, or not interested in marriage, but a good friend. Perhaps more of this needs to occur right up front. The initial step is to determine what you are ultimately looking for in your relationship endeavors. Some men and women have said they let it be known the first time they're together with a new person what their long-range goals are. Then, as soon as possible, they try to discover what the other person is seeking. Everyone has some kind of plans or preferences. One way to draw someone out is to share your own. If you're looking for a marriage partner and this new person isn't, why waste your time? If they indicate they are, too, but for the past 12 years they've had one series of 6-month relationships after another, what does that tell you? You hope you'll be the answer to their searching, but that's a high risk. A person's relationship history may have a message for you, too. Here's what a 33-year-old woman shared as her criteria: what I look for in a godly man. Spirituality is the umbrella, and then there are things under that. If the umbrella isn't there, I don't care what the outer appearances of the guy are. He might be a looker, a charmer, quite a talker, a doer, a go-getter. However, if the evidences of a strong walk with the Lord are not there, I am not interested. However, once under the umbrella, qualities I find attractive are as follows: a person of whom my parents approve, a person who is trustworthy, a person of integrity, his word is his bond. When he says something, I feel confident it is going to be done. When he says something, I know he is going to do it. Someone I can look up to, a person I would like to emulate. Someone that's courteous, not one that will put me down. A good listener. A supportive person. We might disagree on some things, but he would listen to my point before making a decision about right or wrong. A good communicator. While I understand we won't always agree on things or have the same opinion of things, I want someone who at least tries to understand and communicate with me. This is one of the more important qualities for which I look. The idea of integrity comes back to mind in all facets of his being. Integrity toward his God, his spouse, his employer, his friends, his finances, and to himself. Does he try to convince himself of something that just isn't the case? Most of this rather strict approach to looking for a godly man is for two reasons. One is that I am a Christian, and the thought of being with an unbeliever is not only repelling, it also is against God's will. The other reason is because I tried it the other way and I know how unhappy I was. I knew I was involved in relationships which weren't the ideal, but I didn't know how to extricate myself from some of the destructive relationships in which I was. With respect to dating, ideally I won't actually date. In other words, I would like to get to know the godly man as a friend. I would like for kissing, etc., not to be an issue. I truly believe that I could meet someone and get to know him on an intellectual and spiritual level and know at that point whether I wanted to marry him. The physical aspect of a relationship doesn't have to be part of the courtship I have with a person. I have enough faith and belief in God that he will work out the physical aspects of our relationship. Consequently, ideas that feel right or comfortable to me are to meet someone in groups of other Christians. I would like to get to know him in groups at least initially before having any one-on-one time. Lastly, and yet most importantly, having come through the background I have, I absolutely believe and know that prayer in a relationship is essential. In fact, it is prayer which will allow God to let me know his will about a particular man in my life. Additionally, praying together is something which will be a must for me. Some individuals are quite satisfied and fulfilled with short-term relationships. This has been their pattern over the years and they are not pressing for marriage. Sometimes those in constant and frequent short-term relationships project the reason for this onto their partners. They say, "She just didn't seem interested in marriage," or "He wasn't the commitment type." Few men are these days. People who follow this pattern of relationships usually have a high or peak intensity of attraction at the beginning, but over the next few months it diminishes. The relationship feels good and often there is intense passion. It's as though there is an addictive chemical at work, but it rarely lasts. You can't always explain why you are drawn to this person, and sometimes who and what they are fails to match up to your qualifications list. Infatuation does not have to have a correlation with reality. Infatuation passion is so common with adolescents, and yet it can become a continuous pattern for adults in their 20s and 30s as well. Unfortunately, when the IP fails to occur immediately, the person may not seem interested in pursuing the possibilities. There is possibly more hope for a relationship developing and lasting without infatuation than with the IP pattern. As a couple dates and the intensity begins to subside, it creates a possibility for necessary evaluation of the relationship and the other person, as well as the opportunity for mature love to develop. If some crisis occurs to make you look at the relationship in a new way, so much the better. This is positive, for this is life. When you encounter a crisis together, you are able to see another often hidden side of the other individual. We are more willing to make changes during some of the crises. When couples who are in pre-engagement or premarital counseling come in and state they had a difficult week or experienced major upsets, my response is, "Wonderful, we'll be able to accomplish more this week." We can use what happened to determine the effect upon your relationship. This is positive. They don't usually see it that way, but in time they will see the benefits. Or if a couple doesn't experience very much upset during the weeks we spend together, I bring up issues and subjects that may cause serious discussion, reevaluation, or even conflict. This is what life is like when you're married. Before you marry is when you need to discover if you can really handle the issues. When you enter a time of reevaluating a relationship to determine whether you will move forward or dissolve it, you will probably consider numerous questions. Do you want to continue this relationship, and if so, in what way? Are you content to maintain at this level, or do you want to work to move it to a deeper and perhaps lasting relationship? Are you capable at this time of making such a decision? Are you capable of sharing whatever your feelings are for the person for a lifetime? Are you considering staying in this relationship for a positive reason, or because it's better than being alone until something better comes along? These are questions to think about early on in a relationship. Perhaps one of the questions for you to consider as you begin becoming acquainted with a person is, does this relationship have long-lasting potential? Ask yourself this question, and rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. Do this each time you see the person and spend time with him/her. Keep track of this for a month and then ask yourself the question, what are these results telling me? To assist you in getting to know a person better, you may want to use the interview questions suggested in Appendix A. Concerns about a long-term relationship. Often I request that my counselees respond to questions during the week in writing. I've discovered that when we see our written response, it has more of an impact. For a person involved in a pattern of short-term relationships or for someone desiring a long-term relationship, it may be beneficial to reflect on your concerns of moving ahead. List 5 of your concerns and then rate their intensity on a scale of 1 to 5. My concerns about a long-term relationship are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now consider some of these concerns that other singles have voiced. What if I'm just fulfilling the other person's needs rather than my own? I'm not sure if we continue that the level of giving to him is reciprocated. I'd like it to be two-way. It's been difficult so far. How do I know it will be any better? I'd like to be closer, but I don't want to lose my independence, either. If we continue in the relationship, she may find other things she doesn't like about me. I could be rejected big time if I'm more attached to her than I am now. I want closeness, but not at the risk of the pain of rejection. I've experienced that before. It tends to be so strong. If we continue the relationship, I could end up being dominated. You know, I'm strong and tend to be controlling. In a short-term relationship, I can put a lid on it fairly well. But the longer I go with someone, the harder it is, especially when I see things that need to be corrected. If I become exclusively involved with someone, it's costly. I have to give up some of my activities as well as opposite-sex friends. Some have been friends for years. So I'm picky. I know it. That's what keeps me from getting serious. I could miss out on someone else who is interesting. Rebounder's warning: there are two types of situations which are definitely hazardous to the health of a future marriage. You've heard about one of them before, especially if you're a basketball fan. In fact, in this sport, it is to a team's advantage to have players who excel in this particular skill. It's called rebounding. A basketball is shot toward the basket, but it bounces off the rim and an opposing player leaps high into the air and grabs the rebound so his team can have possession and now move toward their goal. Catching the rebound in basketball is positive. Catching a person on the rebound is not. I see it all the time. A dating relationship is broken or a marriage is broken because of death or divorce, and very soon the person is involved with a new person. Often the rebounder is in intense pain over their loss, and instead of experiencing the loss and grief on their own, they attempt to cover some of the pain by attaching to a new person in their life. The positive feelings are much more positive than the ache of the empty place in their life. In a sense, the other person is being used as an anesthetic by the rebounder to numb some of their hurt. You may be healthy and able to commit to a relationship at this time, but they aren't there yet. Rebounders enter into premature involvements which hinder them from healing and contaminate their new relationship. Both people need to be stable and healthy for a relationship to have a chance. Point 47. If a person is now single because of the death of a spouse, was it a lingering, long-term terminal illness that led to the death? If so, there could have been a great deal of anticipatory grieving, and the person could recover much more rapidly following the death. But if not, it usually takes an average of 2 years for the grieving to occur after what we call natural death. But if it was an accidental death, it usually takes 3 years, suicide, 4 years, and death by homicide, usually 5 years. This is why grief recovery groups are important before moving into a new relationship. When a divorce occurs and the person is the rejected one, not only is there the loss of the relationship, but there is the pain of the rejection as well. Too often the person is moving into relationships before the divorce is even final. Numerous times men and women going through divorce have asked me if it's all right for them to date yet. I usually toss the question back to them by asking, in the eyes of the state and God, are you single or married? When they admit the truth, tell them, if you're still married, then you're not eligible to date yet. Once you're divorced, attend and complete a divorce recovery group. Then wait at least a year before even considering dating. You won't be ready until at least that time. If you get into relationships before that time, you're probably rebounding and looking for someone out of pain and need rather than from a healthy choice. Many counselees don't want to hear this. But those who remarry too soon are another divorce casualty waiting to happen. Perhaps the kind of rebounding often found in broken relationships is best illustrated by throwing a racquetball against the wall of a small room in your home. It bounces erratically back and forth from wall to wall. One young woman described the process in my counseling office: I feel as though I'm on a combination merry-go-round, bumper car, and roller coaster all rolled up into one. If avenue to be on the go constantly, or I think I'll go bananas. I'm always doing something and jumping into one relationship after another and unfortunately, one bed after another. I don't like myself for doing this, and it makes me feel even worse about the relationship I lost. I've decided to find some more constructive things to do with my time and to stay home on Thursday and Friday night each week to prove that I'm able to do it. It hurts, but I think I'll recover by doing this and I'm sure I can grow through this experience. I don't want to be chained to him forever, and I think I have been. Some may be ready for a relationship earlier than others, but you need to ask this question: am I being considered for who I am, a unique person they're interested in pursuing for me, or am I looked at as a cure? The other question is, am I looking at the person I'm interested in as a cure, or am I regarding them for who they really are? How can you tell, though, if this new person in your life is a rebounder? First of all, before you invest too much time, discuss yours and his/her last relationship. If it was long-term, either dating or marriage, go into detail about the type of relationship, what caused the termination, how long ago, what he/she has done to recover, and how this person is doing in their adjustment. This is not being intrusive, but safe and practical. You may want to discover how similar or dissimilar you are to their former partner. I have seen many people choose men or women just like their former partners, defects and all. These replacements will probably be just as disappointing as the previous partners were. But something drives them to prove that they can have relationships with people like this. Perhaps it is to prove to themselves and their former partners that the defect wasn't in them. This is why many daughters who have non-affirming, aloof, distant fathers choose husbands who are very much like their fathers. The similarities could be in personality characteristics, behavior, values, beliefs, etc. Before any person can move ahead with a new relationship, it's necessary to say goodbye to the former person. It's the final step in the stages of grieving over a relationship. More will be said about this in a later chapter. Rebounders tend to manifest certain characteristics, and if you see these in the other person, be cautious. If the other person has requests or demands which lead to major change in your life without your receiving need fulfillment, that's a warning sign. It could be a rebound symptom or an ingrained personality trait. In either case, it's not healthy for you. Often rebounders use projection to ease the pain of their breakup. They heap blame upon their former partner and focus on his/her negative traits. This tendency may keep them from seeing or assuming their part in the breakup. If they continue to badmouth their former partner as your relationship is building, they are still emotionally involved with the former partner, but with negative feelings. The anger which is there could lead to resentment, which can create a bitterness not just toward the original source, but perhaps to other people in their life and even you. You may want to discover who else they have blamed in their life for their misfortunes. You certainly don't want to be an addition in their trophy case of bad guys. Another way to numb yourself from the pain of the loss, especially if you were the one rejected, is to deny your former partner's good points. Statements such as these deaden the pain of the loss. You know, that person really had a lot of problems and defects. She or he wasn't who or what they said they were. I'm better off in the long run finding someone else. Another question for you to consider is whether this person is the one who broke it off with his/her former partner or if he/she was the one rejected. In either case, has this been a pattern over the years? Where is their former partner now? Are they dating someone in a new relationship or married again? If so, am the first person my new partner has had an interest in or have there been others? If you are the first one, why have they waited until now to pursue a new relationship? Prebounders, there is a second type of situation that is hazardous to the health of a future marriage. I haven't known what to call it until recently. One author called them prebounders. They're very similar to the rebounder, except they are still involved in their current relationship while they're looking for a new one. Once they are assured of a new partner, then they decide what to do about the present one. But who's to say that they might not give up the former relationship and keep two going at once? I've seen as many as five at one time. And if problems occur between the two of you, it's quite easy for them to return to their former partner. Now you're the one left out in the cold. Here are some questions which would be helpful for you and your future if you know the honest answers. You may need to find creative ways to discuss them with your new interest. It's also vital that you answer them honestly for yourself. The questions pertain to, is it really over? 1. How frequently do you think about your former partner and in what way? Is it negative or positive? 2. How frequently do you have contact with your former partner and in what way? What is the purpose? What feelings do you experience on these occasions? 3. In what ways are you similar to this former partner? 4. On a scale of 0 to 10, to what extent do you have a fear that this past relationship may repeat itself again? 5. On a scale of 0 to 10, to what extent do you experience guilt over the previous relationship? How might this guilt be affecting you in building a relationship with another individual? 6. On a scale of 0 to 10, to what extent do you have anger toward the previous relationship? If there is anger, what can be done to resolve it? I know. You may be thinking, we could never discuss these. But at some time you can. Not only that, you need to. After all, it's your future. You will discover the answer one way or another. It can happen directly or in a way that could disrupt your relationship. If you are involved with a rebounder or prebounder, you're being used as a crutch. Keep in mind that when a broken leg heals, the crutch is discarded. It's something to consider. Think of it in this way. If you go to a new medical doctor, what does he do to help you? First, he takes a medical history with some questions that don't always seem to pertain to the ailment you brought to his attention. But in order to properly evaluate you, the doctor needs the total picture. If you seek out a therapist for counseling, in some way or another you are asked to share your past history. A therapist wants to deal not only with the present problem, but also with how it developed and how it affects you. That way he can better help you. Evaluating a potential mate isn't much different and is important for your future. Before you consider moving into a possible long-term relationship with someone and possibly marriage, let's consider the, I don't need these kinds of problems, issues. If the problems are present at this time, you may want to consider them as either a caution or, stop the relationship, sign. Givers, takers, and commitment phobia. Years ago I read a book called The Givers and the Takers. It divided people into one of two camps. Ideally, we have the ability to both give and receive. This is healthy. But if your partner is exclusively one or the other, you can count on one thing: your needs won't be met. If your partner uses threats of any kind to force you to continue to be involved with him or her, such as violence, mining your reputation, or suicide, you need to become uninvolved as soon as possible. Some individuals have difficulty accepting no. I am amazed at the number of married Christian couples who use the D word as a threat to control their partner. Threatening divorce is unhealthy in a marriage. If you have a partner who uses threats to get their way, you might consider showing them the door. If your partner has a pattern of abusiveness in their background, how can you be sure that you won't experience this if they've never received help or treatment for it? In the last 2 decades, our English language has been inundated with many new labels in an attempt to explain relationships and problems in life. Many books are talking about one label that perhaps answers why some individuals never marry. The new villainous label in town is commitment phobia. It's even been suggested we have an epidemic of this problem. It's especially painful for the partner in a relationship who deeply loves the other, but the partner cannot bring himself or herself to make a commitment. Numerous books discuss this problem, and usually the man is the culprit. A few titles are The Dance Away Lover, The Go Away Come Closer Disease, The Playboy Syndrome, Flight from Commitment, The Peter Pan Syndrome, and Men Who Can't Love. A commitment phobic is a person who has a strong, insatiable desire for affirmation from the opposite sex along with a resistance to commitment. They don't want to be alone, but they don't want to be too close. And just when they get too close, they retreat. Their double message is, come closer. Don't get too close. Come here. Go away. They're unhappy alone and unhappy if they're going to be tied down. How do you detect commitment phobics? If they have a history of short-term relationships, be aware. Do they cancel dates with you or change arrangements frequently? Do you find yourself being hurt by them? Do you see them settling down and changing their pattern? If not, be careful. If for some reason you have a strong feeling you're involved with such a person, get out. Don't try to discover why he or she is like this or think you can change the individual. You won't and you can't. It's easy to fall into the trap of, I wonder why she cancelled again, or, I wonder why he's retreating. You probably will never find out. Move on to someone with potential. Another concern for the women are the committed bachelors. A newspaper carried an article with the title, Bachelor Fad, in which it stated that more and more men are choosing the single life rather than marriage. Many men do postpone marriage to pursue educational and career goals. The author of the book Bachelors, The Psychology of Never Married Men found that many men didn't marry because it was their choice not to. The study revealed that many men shared three types of defenses in relationships: avoidance, isolation, and distortion. The single men appeared reluctant to become involved emotionally, make demands, or share their needs in sexual relationships. Their defensiveness and isolation allowed them to interact with women, but on a superficial level. Emotions were not shared. Overall, their tendency was to be standoffish, indifferent. If there were any situations in which they might be hurt, avoidance was used. The surprising feature of this study, according to the author, was that only 5% of bachelors over 40 ever marry. I've seen some strange combinations in premarital counseling. I've talked with couples who were going to be married where one of them didn't especially like the partner, but felt that wasn't necessary if physical needs were met. Another couple admitted they had a physical attraction to one another and financially they had similar goals, but they were not sure that they liked one another's personalities. Why would people even consider marriage with these liabilities? Yet they do. Reasons for continuing a losing relationship: of the numerous problems mentioned in this chapter, think about them in this way. If there is an issue now, why wouldn't it be a problem after marriage and with greater intensity? If you can take the necessary steps to resolve the issues, that would be wonderful. But that will take time. Point 50. Why would you want to continue a relationship when the problems are so obvious? There are several reasons. It could be a struggle with low self-esteem. One 40-year-old counselee described her dilemma with her boyfriend. She told about his constant put-downs which made her self-esteem crumble. I asked why she didn't break up the relationship, and she said, I would miss out on the companionship I have. I'd be uncomfortable starting over with someone else. And maybe his negative perceptions of me are accurate. If you hear negatives enough, you begin to believe them. Some individuals seem to be ruled by their feelings regardless of the objective facts. I see those who spend their time in romance novels and in feeding their fantasy life about an intense romantic love relationship falling into this group. Sometimes what you fantasize about becomes so intense that it can override the reality that you are in, and you fail to notice the danger signals. Obsessive lovers: some people are addicted to love, no matter what the consequences. In a healthy relationship, you may hope and even idealize that perhaps you have found the person who may be the fulfillment of your hopes and dreams. But it's balanced with the realization that it may not work out. You have a safety net called reality. An obsessive lover works without a net and doesn't even understand the word doubt. When they find a new person, they cry out, "Yes. This is my magic person who can fill all my needs and give me happiness." Their fantasies and expectations about this special person have very little to do with who that person really is. Their focus is on what they need and what that other person can do to meet those needs. 51. A person such as this lives with the myth of the ultimate passion. For the person being pursued initially, it may be flattering but in time suffocating. Does this fit anyone you know? For people to fit the pattern of the obsessive lover, they need to meet four criteria. This includes having a consuming, intense, even painful preoccupation for a real or wished-for person in their life. They seem to be consumed by either possessing this person or being possessed by them. Here is where rationality breaks down. The person they desire must be unavailable to them in some way or may actually reject them. They may have said, "I'm not interested," "I'm not available," or "get lost." But it doesn't matter to the obsessive lover. The rejection actually feeds and frightens the obsessive love. Because of the unavailability or rejection, they begin to behave in self-defeating ways. 52. Their fear of rejection can have the same effect as having been rejected. And it's a self-defeating way to live life and create a healthy relationship. The rejections are creatively rationalized. Statements like the following are common: I know that she dates other men, but they really aren't significant to her. She really cares only for me. She 11 realized that soon. I call him several times a day and he hangs up. He just can't face how much he cares for me. I guess he's overwhelmed by it and can't handle it. Someday he will. He hasn't called for 2 weeks. It's happened before when work gets really busy. When it lets up, he'll be back. But all these statements deny the truth. When sex is a part of this kind of relationship, it further clutters the relationship. In most obsessive relationships, sex plays a major part. And it's usually very intense and pleasurable. The problem is it's used to measure the intensity of love, of compatibility, whether the other person cares, and leads to idealization of the other person. The obsessive person uses the sexual relationship as a sign of certainty that this relationship is the one for his or her life. But often the intense, passionate sex has been mistaken for love, and the short-term passion makes any rejection hurt even more. As I have worked with couples in premarital counseling, I've found that about half of them have a pure sexual relationship. They are not having, nor have they had, sexual intercourse. For those who are engaging in sexual relations, I ask them to bring this to a halt and to maintain a pure sexual relationship until the wedding night. They agree to this, and in time some of them make a decision not to marry. Why? Several have said, including men, that now that there was no sex, they could see their problems more realistically and the driving passion that had seemed to be the glue that kept them together. An individual can overcome an obsessive love differences and put all involvement and dating on hold until it is resolved. It can lead to obsessive pursuit, revenge, stalking, and even violence. Do you or someone you know fit this list? An obsession with love can have the following characteristics, and it only takes a few of these to indicate a problem. They yearn for a person who isn't physically or emotionally available to them. They live for the time when their desired will be available to them. They believe that if they want them enough, eventually they will have to love them. They believe that if they continue pursuing this person long enough and hard enough, they will accept them. When they are rejected, they want the person even more, and continued rejections lead to depression or rage. They feel victimized because of the lack of response on the part of their partner. They believe only this one person can fulfill their life. They are so preoccupied with the person that their work is affected, their eating, sleeping, etc., or they call the person constantly and at inappropriate times, watch them, check up on them, etc. 53. This may sound sick to you. It is. But it is reversible. The person can develop normal and healthy relationships. Considerations for a long-term relationship. If you are looking for a long-term relationship that will be fulfilling to both of you, there is no time limit on how much time to take to get to know this other person in all kinds of settings and under all sorts of circumstances. Work with them for 2 or 3 days straight on a mission project of your church or doing the cooking and cleaning up on a weekend for junior high students. Be with them on extended occasions with their family or close friends. If possible, spend a day with them at work, paint a room together, shop with them for several hours, etc. How much time should you give to move from short-term to long-term? Let's say 3 months to a year. You can't rush this process, nor can you bypass it. I see and hear about couples all the time who execute a courtship bypass, but in most cases the surgery isn't successful and eventually the patient dies. Recently I heard about a couple who met and in 7 weeks were engaged. Both said that it just feels right. They haven't had time for any difference or crisis yet. Another couple in their 20s became engaged 3 months after meeting because of her dream of getting married, their physical relationship, and the extra money he would make by being married while in the army. There has to be time for the infatuation, physical attraction, chemistry, or whatever you want to call it to subside so you can deal with the real issues of life and allow love to develop. Whatever the initial chemistry was will hopefully continue and balance out, but much more needs to be added. If the relationship experienced intense passion because of sex and the romantic high begins to wane, couples who feel that the romantic high is essential usually do not stay together. The odds against eternal passionate love are insurmountable. When you understand this and choose to be satisfied with the quieter feelings of satisfaction and contentment, a relationship has more of a chance. Time lets this happen. Even secular sociologists and demographers have identified predictors of what contributes to a happy marriage and indicators of a marriage that lasts. Two of them are that you married after the age of 20 and you dated for a long time before getting married. 54. How have you been praying about this future step? Bringing a relationship before God and asking Him for clarity, insight, and wisdom is a significant step. Looking at the relationship in light of Scripture is another way to discover God's will. With every relationship, focus on Proverbs 3 verses 5 and 6, lean on, trust and be confident in the Lord with all your heart and mind, and do not rely on your own insight or understanding. In all your ways know, recognize and acknowledge Him, and He will direct and make straight and plain your paths. Then ask yourself, will this relationship lead me to a stronger and fuller expression of reflecting the Word of God in my life or less? The answer to this may be all you need. Before pursuing a long-term relationship, list the indications that this has been satisfying enough for you to pursue. Seeing it in writing brings greater clarity. When I work with premarital couples, they think this issue through very carefully and thoroughly and bring to their initial session a list of 10 indicators as to why this is the time of their life to marry. I'd like to see this happen at the transition from a short to long-term relationship and once again when a couple begins to entertain serious thoughts about marriage. Here are some indications or reasons that others have shared with me for your consideration. A man in his 40s shared the following: after my divorce began a biblically oriented study into the reasons for the failure of my marriage. Relieved that process has paid off quite well in terms of my building a genuine Christian lifestyle and learning the basic commitment and maturity required for a Christian marriage. I've also dated rather extensively in the last 5 years and have gotten to know many women from all walks of life. In the process, I began to formulate a list of required and desirable characteristics I would need in a significant woman in my life, based upon 1, biblical mandates and principles and 2, my personal preferences, desires, needs, hopes, etc. For the first time in my life, I have an established criteria or value system by which to evaluate a potential partner. This man did find his partner. His personal growth and careful planning paid off. A woman in her 30s shared the following: the time is right because for the first time the person is right. There were others with many fine qualities, too, but along with these Tony is the right person. One thing that is so comforting is that when he has an off day and is disagreeable, grumpy, or is out of sorts, I still love him. That in itself is reassuring. What about it? Are you emotionally and spiritually where you want to be and ready for what it takes in a long-term and hopefully permanent relationship? Have you dealt with all of your concerns? Have you completed the evaluative steps that are necessary? This may be your time to move forward. When you're thinking that marriage is in the future, take the next step and begin premarital or pre-engagement counseling. The opportunity to spend 6 to 10 hours with a minister or counselor can assist you in identifying issues which you may have missed, will help you eliminate future surprises, and will assist you in developing skills that you will need in marriage. Appendix B will give you additional information concerning the structure and resources of premarital counseling. Relationships 151.